The crew aboard the International Space Station is struggling to fix a major problem. A pump in one of the station's cooling systems failed 10 days ago. Tomorrow, two crew members are scheduled to perform a spacewalk to replace the critical pump. But as NPR's Joe Palco reports, the walk probably won't be enough to solve the problem.
The failed pump circulated ammonia through one of two cooling systems aboard ISS, the International Space Station. Without it, the cooling system is inoperable. And cooling is essential. Michael Suffredini is ISS manager. He spoke to reporters last week about the problem.
All of the systems, other than some of the components out on the truss where the power modules are, get their cooling from this cooling system.
Without it, all the equipment aboard the station would overheat and the crew quarters would be uninhabitable. There is another completely independent cooling system that's working just fine, but the failed pump means there's no margin for another failure.
If we lose the next cooling system, then we don't have the ability to cool most of the components on board ISS, and so that would be a significant challenge to the team to work through that.
Significant challenge might be an understatement. The Russian modules that make up ISS have their own cooling systems, so the entire crew of six would have to live in there until one of the ammonia cooling systems could be repaired, and it'll be a tight squeeze. Suffredini says NASA knew a pump might fail.
This is an anomaly we knew someday would happen. It's an anomaly that we have trained for. It's an anomaly that we have planned for. So, I mean, we're in a good position to go solve this problem. It is a significant failure, though, and so it's one we need to go get after.
NASA managers were hoping that two spacewalks would be sufficient to replace the pump with one of the four spares at the station. But the astronauts performing the first walk last Saturday found an ammonia leak that prevented them from removing the failed pump. Suffredini spoke again to reporters Saturday afternoon after the spacewalk.
Obviously, we didn't get quite as far as we had hoped to today.
The plan now is to try again tomorrow. Chief Spacewalk Officer David Beaver says there's still several things to disconnect before the failed pump can be removed.
One fluid connection. There's also five electrical connections that need to be done after that's completed. And then there's four bolts that will need to be released.
Then the new pump has to be bolted into place, all the lines connected, and the old pump stowed away. Suffredini says it will most likely take a third spacewalk and possibly more to complete the repairs.
We will get through this problem. The challenge is to get through this problem before the next problem hits the other cooling system.
Losing the existing system isn't an idle concern. The pump on that system is the same age as the one that failed. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
You are listening to All Things Considered. When essayist Ralph Eubanks feels the summer heat steaming from the pavement, he often thinks back to his Mississippi childhood, to one of his favorite refuges on a hot summer day, an air-conditioned bookmobile. A recent trip to Chicago conjured just such a memory when he happened upon a whole parade of bookmobiles.
There it was, an old Ford grille with big round headlights. That was a dead ringer for the bookmobile that stopped at my house as a child. All of a sudden, I was transported into my boyhood self, waiting in the heat of my front porch for the Pine Forest Regional Library bookmobile to arrive at my house in rural Mississippi. Like the boy I once was, I shyly approached the door and asked if I could take a look inside. I stepped into a cool, air-conditioned bookmobile, and memories began to pour over me as I looked at the shelves and began to remember many of the books I borrowed. Across Five Aprils, Johnny Tremaine, My Side of the Mountain. One summer, I read every Agatha Christie mystery ever written. The summer I turned 11, William Faulkner's The Reavers came off the shelf of the bookmobile because I had read it was being made into a movie and that the main character was my age. It was the first book I read by a Mississippi author, the first hint that someone from my part of the world could also become a writer. The bookmobile began stopping at my house in the summer of 1965, 1 year after the passage of the Civil Rights Act. As a boy, I took it for granted. a library on wheels was just part of the rural landscape. Isolated on a farm and oblivious to much of the turmoil of the civil rights movement, most Wednesdays I was finishing a book on the front steps when I heard the bookmobile's tires rush over the gravel in my driveway. The civil rights movement remained distant, even though I knew that because I was black, I could not go to our local public library. Even after the passage of the Civil Rights Act, Mississippi resisted enforcing it. But when my mother asked for the bookmobile to stop at our house in the summer of 1965, the librarian did not hesitate, even though schools were still segregated. By simply following the law rather than ignoring it, the bookmobile transformed me into a lifelong reader and, eventually, a writer. It was through reading that I became aware of the desire to tell my own stories. Reading also brought out my innate curiosity about human nature, which made me explore ideas beyond the page. So it is my identity as a reader that shaped the type of writer I am, and I owe that to an old Ford bookmobile, a summertime pleasure that changed the way I see the world. Rather than feeling alone and isolated in turmoil-ridden Mississippi in the late 1960s, a cool, air-conditioned library on wheels connected me to a world beyond the limits of where I grew up. In my life, that has made all the difference.
Ralph Eubanks is the author of Ever is a Long Time, A Journey into Mississippi's Dark Past. He's director of publishing at the Library of Congress. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. The Federal Reserve acknowledged today that the economic recovery has lost momentum, and so the Fed announced a shift in its strategy to stimulate growth. Fed officials said they would buy more U.S. Treasury debt. To explain what that means and why it matters, we turn now to NPR's Jim Zarrilli. Jim, what exactly is the Federal Reserve doing here?
Well, you know, in difficult economic times, one of the things that the Federal Reserve can do when it wants to stimulate growth is go out into the financial markets and buy up securities, things like treasury bills, mortgage bonds. The idea is that when the Fed buys, let's say the Fed buys a mortgage bond from an investor somewhere, well, that investor gets money and that investor may take it and reinvest it. And in, at least in theory, that means, you know, more economic activity, more lending, and hopefully more hiring by companies in the long run. Now, ever since the financial crisis, the Fed has been just buying up securities like crazy. Now, they regularly come due. Let's say somebody, you know, refinances a mortgage. The Fed gets a little bit of money from that. Until now, the Fed would just take that money that it gets and wipe the security off its balance sheet. But today the Fed said it was going to start taking the money and reinvest it. It was going to go out and it would go out and buy new securities. In other words, its balance sheet is going to stay about the same size as it is now.
So how long will it take before we know whether this does what it is supposed to do, whether the Fed does what they're trying to accomplish?
Well, It will take a while. I don't think anybody expects that it's going to do much very quickly. The ostensible purpose of this is to sort of keep money flowing into the system, which will help keep interest rates low. A lot of economists were saying today, you know, that in absolute dollar terms, this what the Fed announced today probably won't make that much of a difference in and of itself. What it does do is send a message to the financial markets that, you know, the Fed is on the case. It's looking for options. It's not going to let interest rates go up too much. So this is probably best seen as a kind of confidence building gesture. And to that extent, it's already had a beneficial effect. Interest rates came down somewhat today as soon as this action was announced.
There was a lot of speculation in the days before this meeting about what steps the Fed might take today. How much pressure are Fed officials under right now?
Oh, a lot of pressure. You know, the economy is not growing at the rate that one would expect at this point in the recovery. The Fed itself today in its statement gave a very gloomy assessment of economic conditions. It said the recovery has slowed in recent months. People aren't spending as much because of high unemployment and tight credit. The housing market, housing starts are depressed. Now, because of the political climate in Washington, it's unlikely we're going to get any significant stimulus spending out of the government. So people are looking to the Fed to do something. And the Fed, it's not clear what the Fed can do. Interest rates, which are the traditional tool the Fed uses to stimulate growth, are already at historically low levels. So the Fed has to go back to the drawing board. There are just a few things it could try, like lowering the interest on bank reserves to zero. But as time goes on, its options are going to dwindle.
Thank you, Jim.
You're welcome.
That's NPR's Jim Zaroli.
The federal government says as much as half of the oil spilled into the Gulf of Mexico from BP's well is still out there somewhere. Scientists are starting a giant search operation, trying to figure out where that oil is and what it might be doing to sea life. NPR's Christopher Joyce is visiting some of those scientists at Moat Marine Laboratory in Sarasota, Florida, and he joins us now, along with chemist Dana Wetzel, who studies the toxic effects of contaminants on marine life. And Chris, let's start with you. Why don't you tell us a bit about how tricky a task this is for the scientists there at the lab?
Well, the cliche is a needle in the haystack, and that's the situation now. As you said, there's a tremendous amount of oil that was never accounted for. It's been dispersed. Nobody seems to know where it is. NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, is taking water samples, but that's a pretty hit or miss situation. Some scientists are using underwater robots, like AUVs they're called. And Moat's got some of those and has helped develop them. And then they're also developing a device here, a kind of a virtual shellfish that measures contaminants, hopefully will be used in the Gulf. And that's something probably best left to Dr. Wetzel to describe. So why don't I hand it over to her?
Great. Dr. Wetzel, what exactly is that virtual shellfish that Chris mentioned?
Well, virtual shellfish is a semi-permeable membrane device. And this is just a passive accumulating device that will allow us to attract oil contaminants from the environment over a period of 4 weeks that will actually simulate what an organism like a fish or an oyster will be seeing as it lives in its environment.
And what would you expect to be able to tell about the effects on either plants or animals that might have been exposed during the spill?
Now that's a tough question. What we're doing with these accumulating devices is trying to simulate what an organism might be seeing when it lives in an environment that's contaminated. So these devices will be deployed for 4 weeks before they're extracted and analyzed. And what that's going to give us is a number. And that number will say, over a period of time, this animal is probably accumulating this much of a contaminant, an organic contaminant. In this case, we're looking, of course, at oil. But that doesn't tell us what that number translates to in what we call an acute or a sublethal effect. And that sort of pathway of research is something that desperately needs to be done.
In other words, the long-term effects that may not be showing up right away but could be over the long haul?
That's correct. We could count dead bodies, and that certainly is useful, but doesn't tell us what's going to happen to the reproductive fitness of this organism. Will that organism, whether it's a clam, a tuna, or a dolphin, is the exposure to this oil at that level going to affect whether or not that animal can reproduce? Or will it affect whether or not its offspring can reproduce? That's something we really don't know. Another thing we don't know is how does this level of contamination affect the immune system? Does it make them less tolerant to diseases or parasites? There are so many questions about sublethal effects that we don't know that we very much need to invest time and effort into finding out.
Can you tell yet, based on what you've seen, at all what the effects have been? If people are asking you, you know, how bad is it down in the Gulf of Mexico, what do you tell them?
Well, what we tell them is that, you know, the focus on this Horizon spill has been to cap the well. And that's absolutely the correct way to have gone. But now that it looks like we have stopped, or they have stopped, the leakage, we need to move to the next phase, which is to assess both the acute damages and the long-term damages. But herein lies my concern. Now that the well has been capped, interest is going to wane, and perhaps the dedication that was there to do the science may not be there anymore.
And Chris Joyce, let's bring you back into the conversation. When Dr. Wetzel talks about interest waning, another concern there, I suppose, would be funding drying up for research like the kinds of things that she's doing.
This is a matter of great controversy at the moment, and in fact, the head of NOAA, Dr. Jane Lubchenco, was just down here in northwestern Florida to talk to scientists about this, some scientists all over the Gulf. How is the money going to be spent? Who will distribute it? Who gets what? And, of course, there's the complication of litigation. This is not just a scientific question to be resolved by scientists. The Justice Department is involved. They're going to be prosecuting BP, most likely. BP is going to be defending itself. So layered underneath all of the scientific research and where the money goes are questions about can the science be published, can it be discussed. All this makes it more than just money, but also a question of freedom of expression.
That's NPR's Christopher Joyce at Moat Marine Laboratory in Sarasota, Florida, along with marine chemist Dana Wetzel. She's program manager of aquatic toxicology there. Chris and Dana, thanks to you both.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Melissa.